Thank you for tuning in to another episode of PolitiTalk with Lane Palmer. Today on the show, we have a special guest named Josh. So Josh, as always, when we start, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to have the political mindset that you do.
Well, I was raised conservative, hyper-right conservative, by a Christian family, very fundamental independent Baptist. And I like to compare, people sometimes are like, oh, Baptist, you know, they're kind of strict with all their things. The closest thing that I have to compare my family to was Westboro Baptist Church, as far as their belief system, growing up. That being said, because of that, I heard a lot of hate taught from the pulpits of many different churches and many different, the mouths of many different people that my parents conspired with or conspired, or however you want to say it. And that kind of shaped a little bit of how I grew up. I grew up where it was normal to be racist. I grew up where it was normal to be homophobic or transphobic or xenophobic. And that was just expected and welcomed in joke form or in any other form that you wanted to use it in. And nothing ever fully set right with that about me, but I adhered to it because it was something that I was taught, and I thought, well, this is how it's supposed to be, right? It wasn't until I got older and I had actually moved away from my family and started to kind of plot my own course in life and started to meet a more diverse group of friends, that I had people starting to call me out for little things here and there. They're like, hey, that's not really right, and here's why. They always take the time to kind of explain anything to me. And it helped answer a lot of those questions and that yearning doubt of why do I feel so wrong about saying these things? Why do I feel so wrong about some of these things being said of others or this belief system? Or why is it that this is a specific way? And all that critical thinking and all that doubt was nourished in a very healthy way by all these friends that I've been able to be around. And sometimes not even friends, just sometimes people just challenging my belief system. And over the course of the years, and especially challenged by the 2016 election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, I found myself deeply thrown into the world of politics and to how much everything we really do as people matters more than we think that it does. Because up until that point, I had the belief system of, well, voting doesn't really matter because I'm only just one person, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, we can't ever think of it like that, because it's the, you have to think of the bigger picture. You can't keep thinking of, well, it's just all about me. And I think that that's something that has kind of encompassed my political belief system and what shapes my political belief system is, it's not just about me. Everything that happens doesn't just affect me. It affects literally millions of people, not just here. It affects people all over the world too. And how what happens in our country affects other countries, and what happens there affects us. And because we have that freedom, we should be voicing that more effectively and more eloquently and actually taking a stance and a pride for what is right.
Honestly, like, you've said so many things in there that's so beautifully said. And a lot of similarities, I think, to maybe how I grew up and how my political beliefs kind of got started too. So thank you for sharing that. I wanted to touch base on one thing, and it was interesting to me that while growing up fairly religious, you said that more so your mindset changed to, like, you know, it's not just about me, it's about other people. And it seems as though, it's like, to me, religion is supposed to be that way, right? Like, you are supposed to be thinking of other people. Why do you think there's that disconnect between religion, spirituality, and caring about your neighbor? Like, why is that a thing?
There is something that I've been very big about making known to people about that specifically. And that is something that is taught in many different churches and is accepted. And it's not just, I'm not going to call it one religion. It's multiple religions. It's multiple different belief systems. Fear-mongering and emotional manipulation is such a powerful, powerful mechanic. Growing up as Christian, we were taught to fear God. It was always fear. This all-loving, omnipotent, omniscient God, we're supposed to fear him. Mm-hmm. Rather, he loves us endlessly, right? But we still have to be afraid of him. Why is that? Because it's a good manipulation tactic. And because of this, it spills over into just so much more than the church itself. Whenever you appeal to that specific part of the brains, there are studies done on this. I'm not going to try to quote any studies on that because I'm not an expert in this field. Mm-hmm. But there are many studies that show that people who are more apt to be fearful and use that part of their brains are more apt to also be more conservative because it appeals to that side. Fear mongering is very strong. It is a very powerful tactic. It is something that you can use. Oh, well, it was used, it's been used all throughout history. Oh, X, Y, Z village is attacking our village. Use that fear tactic and I will be your ally in this. Or you can look back in Nazi Germany for a perfect example, the anti-Semitism that happens because of that. They're taught to be fearful and to abhor these Jews for no reason other than just fear tactic of they're going to take your jobs. Wasn't that the main course that Hitler had the first time that he ran, where he, of course, failed that first time? He used that as fear mongering and it built up, and we're seeing those same effects build up here in our own country and through many different ways, whether it be South Americans coming crossing borders illegally and taking their jobs. Well, what jobs are they taking? Like, there's no critical thought put into that. It's just this fear tactic that we're taught, and Christianity being the way it is so normalized in all of that and ingrained in all of our culture that it's normal to hear that on a Sunday sermon. Mm-hmm. It's normal to hear some type of microaggression or micro hatred, sometimes as I like to call it, against minority groups or against XYZ group, because it's easier to control that.
Yeah. Another thing that I love that you touch on was the fact that you had such a strong support system of friends who were willing to discuss things with you. I think, especially right now in our political climate, I often get a lot of flack because of the people that I surround myself with. And like you, the reason I do it, I think, is because not only do I want to have a broad worldview on what's going on, I also want to be able to help people that I really care about come out of situations that may not be the most healthy for them. And obviously understanding like your own boundaries and what is and isn't appropriate, and that is obviously a discussion that you can have for another day. But I get a lot of flack because I do have some friends and family members who are QAnon supporters. And I think I was doing an interview the other day where somebody was talking to me about it, and they said, you know, how they're idiots. How could you talk to somebody like that? And I'm like, well, here's the thing. QAnon supporters tend to be older adults, right, who can't discern articles on the internet. I mean, like our generation, we were taught how to find an academic source. And like our parents were never taught that. You know, they know some things in the internet are fake and they can spot those pretty easily. But when you have a website that's laid out like the Wall Street Journal and they're publishing these articles, another thing it plays to is the fact that, like, you know, these parents, it's telling all these parents, like, oh, by the way, your children are at risk of, like, you know, sex trafficking and, like, you know, all of this stuff. Like, it plays to that parental fear you have of wanting to protect your child. And so it's like, I don't fault them for that because, again, as you've said before, it's placating to a fear and it's very controlling and manipulative and very effective. So in your personal life, you know, what are your friend groups look like? What are your dynamics? Like, have you kind of taken up the mantle to be that for other people, or how do you direct your life now?
Yeah. So, my biggest thing is I am a person who loves learning, and because of this, way that my mind has been more open, I'm more willing to be around people who I wouldn't typically be around usually. And I try to diversify my friend groups as much as possible and to make sure that I am always welcoming and loving to anyone who enters my life, because my personal motto is I want people to leave in a better mood after they have met me than before they met me, because a positive impact is much better than any sort of negative impact. And that boils down to literally anything I do when it comes to like conversations or debates with anyone. I want to make sure that it's always in a positive light. We're trying to learn something from each other, even if that means just learning how the other person works, even if nothing of our opinions even changes or our stances even changes, at least we learned a little bit more about the other person. So I always try to be very open and welcoming to people around me to be able to feel open and discuss subject matter like this. There is, of course, some lines that we do have to set some boundaries, of course, to some extent, but keeping that conversation more open and willing allows people to feel like they can be comfortable and open up to you, and they're like, okay, maybe for once in my life I can talk about something and someone's actually willing to listen to me, and I don't just have to spout a rhetoric to try to get my point across.
So let's focus on, you know, touching on the 2016 election. How did you react to a lot of what was going on? Were you originally a supporter of one person and then changed your mind? Or, like, you know, walk me through that process of Josh during 2016.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have always been under the mindset of, why don't we have things like universal healthcare? Why don't we have things like more funding for college and more funding for education? Like, why is it that schools are suffering? Why is it that a lot of these quote unquote socialist ideals, why are these not more mainstreams when every other developed country is using this to, in some extent, and doing it very well and proving to do it very well? Why are we so against that? And because of that, that shaped a lot of my opinions into candidates. And of course, 2016 was the first time I ever voted in my life. And because I could just feel the pressure of that election. Of course, being a gay man, you feel it even more now that I'm getting older, because I want to make sure that the younger generation of the LGBTQAI community, and especially any minorities, are given the freedoms they so rightfully deserve. And I was, of course, drawn to Bernie Sanders, as I'm sure a lot of people my age were, who have more of those socialist ideals. He adheres to a lot of that. Of course, he isn't necessarily the ideal candidate for a lot of us, but he is a phenomenal first candidate to help open those floodgates and kind of help make that change happen, or even foster the ideas so someone else can come in and help make that change happen. It was definitely hard to see how the election worked, especially with the Democratic Party siding so forwardly and openly with Hillary Clinton, which I am not a big fan of Hillary Clinton. I never have been. However, do I think that she was the better choice than Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton? 1,000%. Like, I cannot say enough how much I believe that she was much better and more qualified, far over, than Donald Trump. However, she would not have been my first, third, fourth, or even fifth pick for that position. But that's how it just played out. And I think the difficulty of being my first time voting, and I'm sure a lot of, well, I'm going to use my age group, millennials going out and voting for the first time, because, you know, we're a hard pressed age group to actually get out and go vote, seeing that the fact that there was such a high popular vote, and seeing that if it were our voices, Hillary Clinton won, but because we still have these archaic systems in place, such as the Electoral College, that our voices were silenced. The majority's voices were silenced, and the ones who actually had the voices were silenced. And I know that that was detrimental to a lot of people. For me, it kind of fueled a fire, because I'm like, this is an injustice, and this is something that needs to be changed, because how many more millions of people would have voted if they knew their voices would actually be heard when it comes down to those actual numbers, and not an electoral college dictating who actually gets into the office, a system that has been in place for far too long, and was used in a time where it doesn't exist in our society anymore. And our society has also changed past needing that type of system.
Yeah. No, it's so, yeah, that was very frustrating to me. I think the moment when I realized Donald Trump was going to be president was when I went to my polling station. Now, mind you, I grew up in a pretty a pretty conservative town, but I would say that we would kind of go back and forth because here in Ohio, obviously, we're a swing state. And I know like all of the Republicans are usually they tend to vote like earlier in the morning, like right as soon as the polls open. So like if there is a line later in the day, like in the afternoon toward the evening, you know that all those people are really Democrats. And I went around like maybe 5 or 6 p.m. I had just gotten off of work and there was nobody there. Nobody there. And I was the only one there. And I like I stayed for a little bit just to kind of watch and see like who would come in. And nobody. I was there for half an hour. There was nobody there. And I talked I talked to the woman, I was giving my ballot to, and I was like, have there been a lot of people here today? And she was like, yeah, we had a rush in the morning. She said, but as the afternoon hit, it's been kind of slow. They've actually sent some volunteers home because we just haven't been very busy. And like that, at that moment, I knew Donald Trump would win. And I was trying to prepare my friends for this too, because you know, a lot of my friends from college, they come from different areas like California and New York. So I think their view is a little blinded at times from the rest of the world. And I'm like, no, like in the Midwest, like this is really a bad thing. Like, and of course he won Ohio. Of course he won all of those states that he needed to win the Electoral College. And it was a very hard time, but I guess, yeah, focusing now on 2020, had any mindsets of yours changed? Did you see any other candidate, I guess, or were you another Bernie supporter this time around as well?
There were actually several more candidates, especially since prior to 2016, I had a mindset that wasn't necessarily fully political in that sense, that there was more, I was more of an activist and a humanitarian at that point, without fully researching any opinions that I had. It was just, I knew that there were some things that weren't right, like a lot of injustices, especially with the Black community or any minority groups in America. It was just something that never set right to me. Once 2020 hit, I had fully formed opinions that I had thought out, researched, debated, talked out with many other people, so that way I could form my own opinion. And once again, I will always bring the topic back to critical thinking is such an amazing skill that people need to still develop. And because of that, this time around, there were actually quite a few candidates. First off, I thought there were way too many Democratic candidates. That was just a little bit absurd. But there was several that I did like. I didn't mind Elizabeth Warren. I didn't mind Kamala Harris, although I have my issues with her. Kamala Harris. I still have issues with her. I didn't necessarily mind Cory Booker. I didn't necessarily mind Andrew Yang. I, of course, loved Bernie Sanders, and he was still probably going to be my first choice no matter what. Biden was not on my list, and I knew that somehow he would probably end up getting the candidacy regardless. It's frustrating to see how the DNC is constantly not listening to its voters and to its supporters, and how there's just they want a picture perfect candidate, quote unquote, one that is good for camera or anything else. And they kind of ignore the overall cries of the people for the need of an actual person in charge, like an actual leader who will take up the mantle of those who are needing it the most. And while Biden is a good candidate, it's fine. He's not at all, by any means, the best candidate, or even like my 10th choice out of all the ones who are there.
Yeah, it was interesting. I had kind of expected the DNC to kind of drop Biden, especially after those first few primaries where it was abundantly clear that everybody was deciding on Bernie. And then I think for their last ditch effort in the media too, as soon as South Carolina came out and it was like, oh, well, Biden won, so we have to go with Biden because he won the Black vote and blah, blah, blah. It's like, first of all, the Black people just don't only live in South Carolina, okay? They're like everywhere. Second of all, South Carolina is always going to go to a Republican candidate. So why would we ever assume that Democrats would ever win in South Carolina? Sorry. And it was
absolutely.
It was so frustrating. And of course, with the pandemic timing and everything like that, it was looking more like the stars were aligning for Bernie. And then of course, like the DNC was like, nope, we got to have these other candidates step down. So of course, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, they stepped down. So the people who had already cast their votes that probably would have cast their votes for Bernie, you know, cause they early voted, they can't do that now. And it was like, the DNC, so frustrating. But as we're looking toward the future, it's abundantly clear that the Republican Party is now the tent of Trump. And there's really no room for conservatives anymore. This is both terrifying and interesting to me, because now they're saying that the January 6th insurrection was not as bad, or some are even doubting that it happened at all. Yeah. So that shows me that tells me that Donald Trump is now going to be the nominee again. And I know that they're going to run with this for the midterms. The way I projected Democrats would lose the midterms and lose the next presidency is if they did not deliver on the promises that they ran on. They've met some, I will admit, they've met a couple, but nowhere near the amount of looking into raising the minimum wage or securing more health care for people. And they're really shooting themselves in the foot, because they're tied up now, because they have this one guy from West Virginia who is essentially a Republican who's holding everything back because he doesn't want to vote on anything that the Democrats put forth. What happens next? I mean, do you have the same fears? Are you worried that this is something that can't be undone? Like, how, when you look to the future, are you hopeful, or how do you feel?
I think that living a realistic life is a good way to live life, but looking through the eyes of a pessimist is never the way to go, because all that does is destroy any hope that we have. You have to remain a realist while still looking through the eyes of an optimist and being hopeful without building up your hopes to the point that it's going to shatter you. By living a more positive aspect, you're going to be reflecting that to the people that you speak with, that you interact with on these subject matters, and hopefully build up some kind of optimism and hope in them that will in turn carry on. Joy and hopefulness is a powerful, also just as powerful as fear-mongering is. It is highly contagious as well. It's very evident when you smile at someone, they smile back, and then they carry that smile to someone else, and it keeps going. And it's sort of the same mentality for that. And while I think there is a lot that I'm very scared of, when hitting on what you said, I also believe that Trump is going to be the nominee again. And what I've always had a problem with this entire process since he decided that he wanted to run in 2015, is it feels almost completely like looking at a history book of Nazi Germany, pre reign of power for Hitler, and building up to that. We are seeing the same effects happen here. We have one big difference, though. The fact that minority votes are so powerful now, and minority voices are so much more powerful here than they were at that time, carries a big role in a lot of this. And I think the way that we're going to kind of shatter and stop that process of history repeating itself in this case is going to rely more on the minority votes and the minorities speaking up and continuing to be champions of this than ever before, which is in and of itself a problem, considering that, you know, America is built on racism and slavery and capitalism. That's all it's built on. And that directly affects minority groups and directly affects those who are advocating for that positive change.
Mm. No, you're so right. Yeah, because you bring up a good point with Brexit back way in I think that was early 2016, if I'm not mistaken, when they had that vote. That kind of signified again to me, too, that Trump could very well win this. I think it just became, it wasn't so much that it was a minority issue. I think it was an ignorance issue. I think there was, yeah, there was a correlation between like people voting and then the next day, like people asking like, what is Brexit on Google? Because like, yes, nobody knew what it was and they were just voting just to vote. And I wonder if, well, I do believe you're right. If the Democrats don't focus enough attention on the issues that are affecting minorities in this country, I do see them either deciding not to vote or to vote against Democrats. And the yeah, reason I say this is because whether we like to admit it or not, Donald Trump did essentially double and sometimes triple his support from minority voters in 2020. Granted, yeah, they weren't a lot, but it was significant enough that we could see that change. Why do you think that Donald Trump gained more support from minorities in 2020?
Because narcissism is a powerful, powerful, powerful drug. Mm-hmm. It is, when you see someone with that much power and that much unwillingness to care and just be unapologetically who they are, regardless of everything Trump's done, we have to hand him one thing. He is unapologetically who he is. Mm-hmm. And that's appealing to so many people, especially those who are struggling. For him, I'm sometimes at odds. I don't fully understand how so many minority groups do support him. And how many more, like you said, it triples, and it blows my mind, especially after seeing what he directly did to minority groups in this country. Like, let's be real, he rolled back so much for trans rights. Everything that happened with the surge of the BLM movement in these past few years, everything, all those attacks against that, you would think it'd be the opposite effect, but it isn't. And I think it's because of that herd mentality, that tribe mentality, and see this person in power who just will not care and will not stop, and it being appealing, that power being appealing. And I think it honestly appeals to like a very bestial side of us. That's not the word I'm looking for, but you understand what I mean.
Yeah. So let's end things on a hopeful note, kind of what you had mentioned before. I think that's a really good thing to say. Let's say that you, Josh, were invited to the White House to sit with Biden and his cabinet team and give them your thoughts, your ideas, your peace of mind. What are some things you would say to him? What are some things that you would bring up in topics of discussion that are important to you?
Listening to the voices of those who are being hurt. Listen to the Black community. Listen to the minority groups in this country. Listen to the LGBTQIA community and what we've been saying and what we've been asking and praying and crying over for years and years and years and decades. And honestly, there are a lot of things that I would love to see changed in this country, like gerrymandering and doing away with that, doing away with the Electoral College. If I had the ear of the White House cabinet, let me tell you, I would keep them in there for a very long time of things that can be positively changed. Listening, getting out of their offices and spending a week living the life of an average American. And by average, I mean the ones who are like you and I, we sometimes struggle and live paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. Living that life, seeing what that's like, seeing our happiness, our downfalls, the way we have to budget, the way we're crying over sometimes not being able to do the things we want, having to cancel events, or even sometimes not having food in worst cases. And getting to experience that firsthand and kind of reattach to the reality of this country that isn't this elated politician cabinet where they're around white collar all day and where they're around these high status, high class people all the time, and just getting back to normal people and getting back to what makes America America and who is here, because that affects so much of what is happening in this country. It affects the way that minimum wage is looked at. It affects the way that college is looked at. It affects so many aspects of life, and just seeing how they're disconnected. And that's what we ultimately need back from our politicians and from our government, is we need them to be reconnected back to not just the high-class Americans, not just the high middle-class Americans, but the impoverished Americans, the low, the like ones who are struggling, the homeless, the lower middle class, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that, honestly. And even just thinking about the year and a half we've been surviving with this virus, and I guess I was a little hopeful as well, like back when it was first going on, that it was like, okay, maybe now people will realize how important it is to not have healthcare tied to your job, because in the middle of a pandemic, if you lose your job, you lose your healthcare. And the, you know, the people at the grocery stores who are risking their lives on a daily basis to make sure that the stocks are, you know, are shelved and shelves are stocked, and you know, do they really still deserve to be making $7.50 an hour? Like, I worry that as we're coming out of this, people are like so hurried to get back to normal that they didn't realize why normal wasn't working to begin with.
Yes.
So, but no, I love that. So, well, thank you again so much, Josh, for coming on. You've honestly inspired a lot of hope in me. I think I tend to be pretty pessimistic at times, but I think you're right. When we come from a mindset of joy and hope and looking at the positives rather than focusing on the negatives, because, you know, that's the Republican playbook, we can make a difference. We can make change happen. So thank you for reminding that in me.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for listening.